We're having Leanne Kranz, who will host a roundtable discussion about social and relational aggression and the need for emotional education. Joining her are Suzanne Marie Fanger, a researcher studying social aggression among preschool-aged girls, also Jennifer Talbot from the local organization Listen to Kids, and Sherry Blackfeather and Lisa Loving will discuss raising boys to grow up with their empathy intact. Keep tuned to KBOO, folks. International Women's Day, let's all celebrate.
I think we should just, why don't you just...
Okay. Hi. Okay, I'm here today with Leanne Kranz,
Jennifer Talbot,
Lisa Loving, I'm Cherie Blackfeather, and joining us on the phone
is Suzanne Marie Fanger. She's a former early childhood educator, now involved in the study of social aggression among preschool age girls. She's also developing curricula in social and emotional education.
And Jennifer, you're with Listen to Kids. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So Listen to Kids, our mission is to end child abuse and domestic violence through prevention and early intervention programs. We work with children 0 through 12. We do programs in preschools and elementary schools, and we work with moms and kids who are leaving domestic violence situations.
Thank you. So we thought we would talk today about social aggression, especially I'm interested in where it begins, because we experience it in our adult lives and in the workplace. People are starting to talk about that more recently, about workplace violence and bullying and aggression. And so I'm interested in looking at where that begins. Do you want to talk about that? Jennifer, you want to talk about that and what you see? And also, you know, here's the other thing. I would really like us today to try and identify what it is so people understand what it is when they see it and experience it, you know how to identify what it is.
Okay, so I mean, it's complex, but one of the reasons why we start working with kids, why we say we work with 0 to 12, is that it isn't something... Are we on?
Yeah, you're on.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry. Pay no attention to me.
Okay, so we start working with kids from the beginning about teaching them about their right to be safe, that everyone has the right to be safe, what that means, what that looks like, what to do when you're not safe. And I think that we dismiss very often children's everyday experiences of violence, so that by the time people are teenagers, we've actually really taught people to interact in competitive, socially aggressive ways. So we're working with preschoolers and teaching them they have the right to be safe, to use their words when they're having problems, to get help from friends, that everyone has the right to be safe, and really sort of starting early. And we also teach adults how to teach those concepts to kids.
How do you teach adults?
So we teach adults, so one of the things we focus really clearly on, child abuse and domestic violence issues. And a lot of times people think those happen separate from the rest of the community. You know, it's like child abuse is happening by sort of monster people or, and to other people that we don't know. The reality is that, you know, 1 in 4 families in Oregon are living with family violence and that it doesn't happen outside of the norm. And so, what that means for parents is it's not this one-time conversation that you sit down and you say to your children, you know, be careful of all these things that could happen. Yay, we've had the conversation and it's over. It's really teaching grown-ups how to incorporate on a daily basis things that you can do with your kids to teach them that they're valued and that they need to value other people. And so we teach parents to really listen to their kids, how to respond to kids, how to talk to them so that they know that their ideas are important. If we want kids to tell us about problems that they're having with peers or violence, then we have to listen to them no matter what they're talking about. Otherwise, if we can't listen to them about small things that don't feel that important to them, they know we can't listen when it comes to the big, scary, important things.
Lisa, you were just telling me you were judging a science fair today at the middle school?
Yeah, so it's me, Lisa. I've got 2 kids, a son and a daughter. They change ages. I think they're 13 and 14 now. And my son has always been a bully magnet from his earliest age. There was a really, really interesting article in the New York Times within the past couple weeks about sibling violence, sibling abuse. Mm-hmm. And that was a real eye-opener. And they talked about how with some of these issues, if you don't track, literally, all the times that your kids pound each other before age 2. Yeah. They're talking about that window of opportunity literally from birth to age 2.
Yeah.
That some of this kind of violent behavior, pushing, shoving, people take it for granted. So here I am at the middle school, just right down the street from KBOO. It's a wonderful place, science fair. All the kids in the school are required to have, you know, this big project that we've all of us have been working on for months now. And so I'm in there judging with my happy, hello, I'm so-and-so tag. And so I'm trying to talk to kids about what they've done with their experiments. And all around me, kids are shoving, shouting, choking, pinching, poking, teasing. Dude, that's the other part of it, too. Teasing. It's not just about the hitter. Mm-hmm. It's the dynamic between the teaser and the hitter. And kids change roles when they do that. So I found myself, because I can't function when the people around me are hitting, punching, shoving, headlocks, right? And so I had to stop everything and chastise these like 4 or 5 kids who are just in the hallway. You know, the teachers aren't there. There's only so many teachers. And teachers, I'm concerned that teachers now are in a position of having to be like drill sergeants or law enforcement, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But, you know, and as soon as I fuss at these kids, you know, you stop it. I'm not going into deep theoretical, do you think you could tone down your, or whatever. I'm like, you know, you stop now, right? These kids look at me like I'm being aggressive to them. And they're rolling their eyes. And to be honest with you, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. I'm looking at these kids. Now, don't roll your eyes at me, right? What is it? What is relational aggression, right? Don't roll your eyes at me. Don't look at me that way. If you put your hands on her, I'm going to take you both out of the building. You know what I'm saying? And when you look at the school, you know, schools in general, I've been a class mommy for years. I used to be the mommy in the lunch line at the elementary school. And different, you know, it seems to me that in my family, I don't put up with both my kids. You know, they're going to tease each other. They're going to get mad. They're going to have hormonal rush issues, right? But I just cannot tolerate them hitting, punching, and the teasing thing gets me too. It's a dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you can establish your own relationships and standards in your home. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my son, he's the oldest child, you know, I feel like my feminism changed when I gave birth to a male human being. And I watched that kid. We raised him with such care. And when you send him out into the world,
right,
they're dealing with everybody else's standards now, and you can't protect them.
Right. Mm-hmm. So to me, I differentiate when I read that interesting article about sibling abuse, mm-hmm. physical abuse in the New York Times. They looked at these issues of, you know, what people do in their household and what they'll put up with. And they said it has nothing to do. It was all based on this huge study of thousands and thousands of households, which is huge. We're not talking about 100 households in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. No, and one of the things that they pointed out in the study that the article flowed from was it didn't make a difference, race or class.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That the same thing can happen in hyper-rich families, right?
Yeah.
Or hyper-poor families, which I thought was fascinating. But to me, when I look at this issue, we're talking about social aggression. Can you get on a bus? Right. Without feeling like the person next to you is freaking you out with their activities? Or can you have kids at your house and be able to let them know that it's not okay to throw your stuff on the floor and roll their eyes when you tell them to pick it up? There's a difference between your house and the outside world, you know?
Right.
And I don't know, when I looked at the other thing that worries me the most too, again, I'm going back to my son. He's 14, and he's always had a very well-defined feminine side, right? And when there's a difference in the standards of behaviors that we set for boys and girls in toddler years, okay?
Right.
And that stuff plays out forever. It fascinates me. And I'm going to take a breath. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to bring Suzanne in. Suzanne, are you with us?
Suzanne is on the phone today from Austin, Texas. And Suzanne, it sounds like a really good time for you to talk about some of those different ways we treat the genders in these early years.
Sure. Since I focus primarily on girls and on social aggression in young girls, I think I'm coming from a slightly different perspective, you know, having spent less time researching the boy aspects of things. But there are a tremendous amount of gender differences in the way that we work with our children, whether we are teachers or parents from a very early age. And the, you know, for example, parents spend from infancy more time talking to infant girls about emotions and about family events than they do to boys. So from a very early age, they are getting a different piece of information about how to behave and what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to keep it really brief and hand it back to someone else.
I just want to jump in really quick, and just because I was talking about my son, it's me, Lisa, talking. He was a heart baby. So when he was born, he had open heart surgery. And I think it made us key in more on him as a person and nurture him more. Mm-hmm. But the thing that got me was, you know, boys endure a huge level of violence.
Yeah.
We let it happen. We step back and let it happen, and then we say, oh, it's because men are aggressive. I wonder. I just wonder about that. And it one of the things that got me about watching my son grow up was all the times that people pushed him around, and their parents, the teachers, all the adults said, well, he's got to learn how to fight.
Right.
If anything happened like that to my daughter, no one would ever say that.
Boys will be boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I also raised a boy. And I feel also like my feminism changed raising a male. And I really felt early on this immense pressure all around me from society to relinquish my own authority about how to raise a boy. That at some point, and the pressure is early, like you said, 2 years old, you know, really by the time they're walking, you're expected to let them go and let a man or the world handle them. And you're supposed to be cutting the apron strings and all that. So the whole mama's boy thing, like I was talking to a male friend of mine recently, he said mama's boy is the worst thing you can be called. Now, he really respects his mom, and he proudly calls himself a mama's boy, but he said it is, you know, growing up is the most derogatory thing that you can be called, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my son and I are very close, too, and I really felt like the thing I struggled the most to hang on to was my authority to raise my son. Because my goal from the moment I knew I had that I gave birth to a boy was that, okay, this is a big deal. I have to raise this boy to manhood with his empathy intact. And I feel that I have done that. But boy, it has been a huge struggle. And, you know, like Lisa was saying, teachers and, I mean, there's just not support for that in the community, in the culture.
Which, to be fair, if you spend time in a classroom, like I was there in a school today, and I spent years volunteering in the kids' classroom, teachers are in a position of being like short order cooks law enforcement. And there's something about the whole system that we've got in our society that doesn't work very well from every angle, you know?
That's true. Mm-hmm. It is true. And I don't mean to dump it on teachers because I think that also teachers bring their own attitudes about boys and girls to school and then treat your kids that way. You know, in the grocery store, I mean, when my son was an infant, I refused to dress him in blue or any identifying marker, right? And it drove people nuts to not know the gender of that baby. It drove them crazy. And the more crazy it drove them, the more determined I was to play my little social experiment out, you know? And I just kept thinking, what, consciously, all the way through, he's 23 now, it's like, what's involved with this? You know, it's like, you just have to relate to this being like a human being. Mm. And it was really fascinating. And then, like, in terms of dealing with social aggression, too, like, he's a real sweetie pie, but I remember when he was in the first grade, there had been a boy, apparently, that had been bullying another boy day after day after day, and he had told the teacher, and the teacher said, stop tattling.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on. And so his sense of justice or injustice, I guess, as the case may be, he saw that the adults weren't going to do anything about it. Yeah. So one day he was drawing in his sketchbook at the lunch table, and he just turned around with his pencil and stabbed the bully boy. And then he got sent home from school, and his sense of injustice was even bigger. Like, wait, I was doing the right thing. And I said, no, you were not doing the right thing. Your feelings about this were right. You know, your feeling about injustice, that was right. That this other, you read the situation right. This boy was picking on the other boy. The teachers weren't being responsible. But your actions were absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. And that was I remember that being a big day for us. And for him at six to realize all those feelings, the rage, even and injustice does not mean you get to turn around and do something violent to somebody else. That doesn't make it right.
That's actually a big part of the work that we do with kids in the classroom, is really talking about feelings and how feelings are all okay. You know, feelings don't hurt anyone. It's what we decide to do with our feelings that can either be a problem or healthy. And I think this issue is so complex because you've got gender role issues. And we also have our notions, again, that unless violence is sort of on the extreme level, we ignore it. And children go, like, I loved how you pointed out how much violence on a daily basis children experience. And then they look to us to interpret it. And when we look away, or we say, oh, you know, they're just playing, or is it broke, or, you know, are you bleeding? No, okay,
right.
Go back. So we minimize their experience of violence. So we normalize it for them by not stepping in, by not teaching them when they're really little what to do with those feelings. And I think about how if at work we had to deal with the level of violence that a preschooler had to deal with, if I had to constantly worry about, you know, someone's going to come and they're going to yank the pen out of my hand when they feel like it and whack me over the head and maybe call me fat, I don't think I'd go to work.
Right.
So it's this weird thing that we do where it's not until kids get older that we start saying, gosh, you know, you guys need to start treating each other nicely. So how did they learn that? One of the things that I, you know, when we do trainings, we talk about that violence isn't, we need to stop thinking about it on a continuum, you know, like the little things on one end of the continuum that aren't so bad, being rude or pushing somebody, and then on the other end of the continuum, clearly murder and, you know, that's bad. We all know that's bad. But instead of thinking about violence on this linear continuum, thinking about it as a pyramid, and that at the base of that pyramid are all of those daily little violences that children endure. And that's what then supports the next level of violence, and then supports the next level of violence. So the more interruption we can do on the smaller things, will sort of break that cycle.
I was wondering, and Suzanne, can you talk about, you know, Jennifer was saying, you know, not just the physical things, but like those relational things. Like Lisa was talking about the rolling of the eyes. Or can you talk more about relational violence?
Sure. I'm not sure what you want me to say about it, but I'm happy to.
Can you give us a description? Like, give us or some examples?
Sure.
Yes, Suzanne. I mean, we've been throwing a lot of terms around, so if you wouldn't mind defining social aggression versus relational, that would be helpful to distinguish it from the more physical violence that we've been talking about so far.
Okay, sure. Well, the first thing I want to say is that generally when these days people talk about aggression, they're referring to overt aggression, the hitting and the punching, and which was until very recently...
Suzanne, I'm sorry, can you talk a little louder?
Certainly, yeah.
Thanks.
Until recently, overt aggression, the hitting and the punching, that was really the only type of aggression that was recognized, and that, you know, I think what you guys have been talking about a lot is, to some extent, the fact that that is, you know, recognized as the primary form of aggression. But then about 15 years ago, people started realizing that there were a lot of other really painful things that were happening, and those have since been classified as the alternative aggressions, and they're, because it's such a new field and new terminology, I think people are still really working to define the different types of aggression. When I refer to alternative aggressions, I tend to use social and relational aggression, and some people use those interchangeably. I use them slightly differently for my own purposes. To me, social aggression is aggression within a social context, aggression that can damage social status, most commonly rumors, gossip. You know, in my preschoolers, it might sound like something as amusing and harmless as, she doesn't know how to play Candyland the right way. You know, or in an older child, it might be a terrible rumor about somebody's, you know, what they've been doing behind the school after school. So then if you look at relational aggression, my definition is that relational aggression is aggression within a relationship, so using the relationship to harm, threatening, exclusion from a friendship. if you don't be the witch, you can't come to my birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
And so those types of aggression have been seen for so long as much less harmful than physical aggression, but for children, in many ways, they can be just as harmful, and particularly for girls, relational and social aggression can cause as much harm, and as a matter of fact, the research has shown that 12-year-old girls would rather be hit or punched than be aggressed against socially or relationally.
Like excluded or something like that.
Yeah, excluded, having damaging rumors spread about them so that they might lose their place in a social group, lose friends. Mean girls, 12-year-old girls. I'm sure you guys all remember sixth grade.
Yeah. You know what, though? I kind of wanted to jump in there. I'm Lisa. I see that kind of social aggression that you're talking about in the workplace. And I can think of many jobs I've had, and my sisters, too. Wow, they're driven kind of crazy by their jobs in some ways. They really do seem to have developed actual paranoia that, you know, that woman over there is trying to thwart everything I do. And I just saw her go into the boss's office, and I know what she's saying, and I know it's about me because they're looking at me when she comes out. And I just kind of wanted to make that leap from childhood. I mean, why are we worrying about this? Because we're worried about what happens to our kids, but also what we endure, and you don't always know what to do. Like my sister, I have a sister who lives, she works in the military. In the military, the story she tells about the things that people do to get ahead and what she's done as a woman in the Navy and all the men who've lined up for 30 years to basically knock her down a few pegs. And that's the way she sees it. I mean, I don't work with her, but deep, deep sense of overwhelming harassment. And both of my sisters, I love them. Maybe this is too much information, but they are both taking pharmaceutical drugs for depression. And this is work related.
Job. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that that's why I'm interested in talking about it too. I mean, I'm interested in children, but you know, children grow into adults. Mm-hmm. And we keep talking about how are we going to make the world safer for children when, you know, we don't. Actually, either one of you could talk about bullies and bystanders. That would be good, I think, because when you said people don't know what to do on the job, they're experiencing this overwhelming harassment. They don't know what to do. I think that not only does the person targeted for the abuse not know what to do, the people seeing it, witnessing around it don't know what to do.
Right. We don't have those tools. that luckily Suzanne is working on for preschool curricula.
Right.
I think what happens, what I'm noticing in the adult world is that, you know, physical bullying is no longer socially acceptable for adults. I mean, it's not acceptable for anyone, but it's even less so as adults. So what I think happens is that we go into those other modes of aggression that are a little more slippery, a little more difficult to pinpoint, document, and we definitely don't have the tools to handle those.
Right.
If you all don't mind, I'd love for Suzanne to talk about this social and emotional education curricula that she's working on to kind of nip this in the bud in the early days. And I think the values are applicable to adults in the workplace.
That'd be great.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that two of the most important things, as Liam was saying, that that I have been working on teaching young children and getting across the importance of is the importance of social education and emotional education for young children. Emotional education being understanding your own feelings, understanding the feelings of others, learning how to cope with difficult emotions, for example, anger. And then social education being basic friendship skills. How do you work in a group? How do you cooperate? What do you do in difficult situations interpersonally? And as we all know, because there's such a tremendous pressure on teachers and on education, very little time is spent, particularly with older grades, on social education mm-hmm. or emotional education. And so I feel that in the preschool, that's really the only time that children can focus on learning those skills, because once they enter kindergarten, it's, you know, reading, writing, and staying with the tests. But in preschool years, there really is a curriculum flexibility to help children develop social and emotional skills so that when they get into the older grades, when they get into kindergarten and up, and no one's teaching this to them anymore, they can take care of themselves. They can solve conflicts on their own, and they can feel comfortable with groups. Without that, I think that, you know, we're going to have a continuing cycle of bystanders, victims, bullies, people who are having a hard time in the workplace as adults. It really needs to be started at an early age as a focus for social and emotional education before we can hope to fix it.
Why do people, so let's talk about why people don't, you know, why are there bystanders when there's bullying? What's going on there? Why do people watch it happen, stand by, or even join in?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that the most classic example, very common, is they're afraid they're going to be next. Mm-hmm. You know, the classic bystander, all they can think is, at least it's not me. Mm-hmm. And they live in fear of the moment when if they try to stand up for the victim, they might become the bystander. A co-teacher was telling me recently how she had been playing with a group of friends, and this one little girl had wanted to come in and play, and the other kids were saying, no, she can't play, she's too young. And so finally Linda stood up for this little girl and said, come on, let's let her play. And the other children instantly turned on her and said, what are you doing? No, I can't believe you said that. You can't play. And the little girl who was trying to be accepted into the group also turned on Linda as a way of gaining access to that group.
So wow.
Suddenly, Linda's out and the other child that she was trying to defend is in. And I think that's the most common scenario, is the fear of being the victim oneself.
You know, I have to say, I have experienced that very exact dynamic on the job as an adult,
mm-hmm.
And in school. But I remember, not just a few years ago in this corporate job that I had, and someone new had come in, and no one wanted to really acknowledge this person. And so I acknowledged this person and asked, and also, you know, said to the other group, I mean, come on, why are you totally ignoring this new employee, this new person in our office? And, yeah, that same dynamic unfolded. It was incredible.
Tragic, really. I think it's also not, it's also behind the idea of bullies and victims. It's even way less discussed than all that stuff. Nobody really talks about the bystander, the role, mm-hmm. and frequently the bystanders are in just as much danger of becoming themselves depressed or having psychological issues later on as the child who is the victim or the child who is the aggressor. It's a really difficult role to be in, but children don't really know, and I think adults don't really know what to do or how to do, and I think young children particularly have no idea that it could be their job to help.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's really important. I mean, it's one reason that, I mean, it is the reason I'm not able to stand by and watch other people be victimized. It hurts me. Mm-hmm. I am suffering from that. That's not an abstract concept. I actually suffer. And I grew up in my household, you know, as a kid, watching my siblings beat each other up, that I felt like I could puke watching that. Like, I physically felt ill. Or if one of them hit me, I physically felt ill. I couldn't hit them back. I felt violently ill from it. I felt violently ill.
But you know what else strikes me about the whole thing, too? Again, I've had these, you know, my adult life, I've had these heavy deadline jobs that are really stressful. And the people that I work with are all hyper-intellectuals because we're all into media, right? And so everybody's driven and they're aggressive. And I had a job 6 years ago working in downtown Portland on a publication. And one day I realized I was the only one in the whole office who was not taking prescription medication for depression. And that to me, I keep coming back to that issue of the drugs we take, legal and illegal, just to cope with what goes on around us. Because I know so many people that take those prescription, I'm saying Xanax, there's so many of them now. And if you read the fine print, check it out, the fine print, the side effect is what? Rage attacks and depression is a side effect. And it says it right on the prescription thing. And it just makes me wonder, how did we get to this point? You know, surely the most powerful country on earth, 21st century, we still don't even know how to deal with our own emotions as adults or as kids, mm-hmm. as women or as men. We would rather pop a pill, and I can't help wondering if it's something to do with our social values, you know, the whole capitalism thing. I don't mean to talk in really irritating ways. You know, whether you're up on the class scale or down on the class scale, you know, one of the things I had pounded into me on the job was, you know, you're going to go for it. You've got to succeed, you know. And when I look at men, too, men, I think this is International Women's Day, and I think that men are oppressed. I just want to say that. And men are told, you're the breadwinner. Mm-hmm. And if you don't bring in money, you know, the promise keepers, remember them, the arch right wing.
I think the
conservative
called
group,
early this morning.
Really? And they're told, you know, you're the leader of your household, and if you're not, you're a failure. And it's like there's something about the greed and the control, power and control, that's part of our, like, social system. I really don't believe that that's true of every culture on earth. I really don't. Right. And it just makes me wonder about the pills. I keep coming back to the pills.
Well, you know, if you want to talk about pills, I think look at how many pills kids are on. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, so now, you know, the adults are all on pills, and then they look at that as a solution for kids. Mm-hmm. By the time my son, oh my gosh, was 14 years old, by the time he was 14 years old, I don't know, not any of his friends, I mean, there wasn't a single kid I knew by the time my kid was 14 that hadn't been told, whose parents or whatever had told, your kid needs to be on drugs. Your kid needs Ritalin. Your kid is ADD. It's like, all these kids, and you know, I watched them one by one, and then it hit my kid too. It was like this teacher actually told me, your kid is ADD. And it's like, I walked into his classroom one day, and there's my kid sitting all the way in the furthest back, farthest away from everybody corner he could be in, drawing quietly in his sketchbook because the rest of the class is throwing paper airplanes, fighting, pushing, pinching, mayhem. I'm like, oh yeah, my kid has attention deficit.
That's funny you would say that, because so my son was in middle school a few years ago, and he was in a classroom where the teacher did not track the violence, and he was sexually harassed. I'm going to look at you and say, mm-hmm. my son was sexually harassed by another boy in the classroom, and the boy would pretend to hump his desk and stuff like that. The teacher always said she didn't see it. She was absent 40% of the year, and at the end of the year, my son got sick in the classroom and threw up. Mm. He had to go to the office. The nurse calls me up and says, your son is sick. I've got to tell you, I think that he needs drugs. I think that he is so stressed out that you should give him some kind of drug. And then I found out later, it's against the law for her to have said that
exactly.
to us. It's against the law.
That's right.
You know, when you think, it's just so weird. We're talking about the daily stuff that stresses us out so much,
right.
and we don't talk about it. I think that it's 3 o'clock, and we have to say, this is KBOO Portland. This is International Women's Day. This is a super cool panel, live panel discussion about aggression. Okay, back to you guys.
Well, Lisa, earlier you just mentioned values, how our values are out of whack, our gender roles are out of whack. Suzanne, I was very impressed with the values that you feel are important to be a part of the social and emotional education materials you're putting together. Are you prepared to talk about some of those values?
Sure, I'll speak briefly about that. I also wanted to just sort of briefly bring back, since we're tackling all the problems of mm-hmm. of the youth of today, to sort of bring back into perspective the idea of one of the, I think, major things that's going on in our childhood culture is the dichotomization of boys and girls, and that's what's causing a lot of the difficulty. Mm-hmm. Certainly not all of it, because as you were all mentioning, there are so many other problems in our society, but the dichotomization of boys and girls from birth, as somebody was mentioning about, you know, boys being expected to wear blue, girls being expected to wear pink. We're living in this very confusing culture where we're told that men and women are equal, and we're given all this, you know, information about, oh, women's rights, that's a thing of the past, now we're all even. We are all on the same playing ground, but at the same time, gender is the first division. We divide from gender from, you know, it's the first question. As Leanna said before, it's the first question that anybody asks when a woman is pregnant. What gender is the baby? And we address children, oh, come on, boys and girls. So I think that this difference of, you know, it causes differences in expectations of behavior, expectations of aggression, expectations of educational ability in all different subjects. It really, it is a wide-ranging issue. Mm-hmm. And to go back to sort of the values piece of what I have been thinking about, you know, it's really important to give both boys and girls the social and emotional education so that to even that playing field again, to give them the same skill set of social skills and emotional skills. And also, I think what values we teach, whether we're parents or educators, and educators can, you know, impart values to some extent, plays a tremendous role as well. You know, for me, a very brief list, teaching children empathy from a very early age. It's really hard to teach, but it's, you know, if it's constantly modeled, you can start to teach children the importance of empathy and the importance of understanding another person's perspective, the importance of cooperation. How do you actually work together with someone as opposed to working against them? You know, how do you work in tandem to make the product of two people a better thing than just in each of you could do if you were, you know, competing for something. Respect for others, respect for diversity, appreciating boys and girls no matter what their personal preferences of style are, whether they're, you know, sensitive boys or girls who prefer wrestling, respecting that diversity, teaching fairness, honesty, compassion. I'll stop there, but that's sort of brief thoughts on teaching values to children and the importance of that.
Well, what strikes me over and over again as I've been researching this subject for the past several months is I think we throw the words around, but it's like I don't think people think about what it really means to be empathic and what it requires to be empathic. My son could not grow to manhood and have his empathy intact if he did not know what his own feelings were, if he could not identify his own feelings. So I always, when he seemed upset, sad, whatever, I would stop and say, what are you feeling? And, you know, he's really good at that. He knows what he feels. That's really important. And over, it's like, what are you feeling right now? If you don't know your own feelings, you can't feel your own feelings. You're not in touch with that. You can't feel anybody else's feelings. You don't know. And so the how-to of these things, how to feel empathy, how to teach empathy, you have to acknowledge a child's feelings and get them to acknowledge their feelings. You know, one time I remember my son was very upset and had been upset for days and days. So I knew he was upset about something he didn't know how to articulate. It was a complicated thing he was upset about. And I said, you know, I tried to talk to him about it. How do you feel? It wasn't really going very well. So, and he was getting angrier and sadder. And, you know, it was just really getting more jumbled for him. So I said, I have an idea. Why don't you draw those feelings one feeling at a time? You don't have to know the name of the feeling yet. Just start drawing. And he drew like 10 different drawings. And when he was done, he could tell me all about every single one of them, why he felt it, what it was about. And he was relieved. And he felt like, oh, this works. You know, so he had a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing. It's like there are other ways like to teach kids how to know themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and adults need these things too because, you know, I'm scared, like my son, you know, now he's out in the world and he's an adult and he's an adult man. So it's like, I can't even go in there and protect him, you know, mm-hmm. like, and the world's mean. And so, it's really difficult, like his first job, his first like real job, he figured out that this woman was trying to degrade his job, like the work he did, like to degrade him, so like it wasn't good enough and this and this. And he tried harder. And then he said, you know what? I do a really good job. I'm quitting this job. I am because... And then he figured out that this woman had a friend who she wanted to give the job to. But she had to degrade him to try to paint this picture that he wasn't good enough or, you know, and he figured it out. And he said, oh, I don't need this. This is somebody else's garbage and they want to. And he said, if you don't want me and you want somebody else or whatever, but don't degrade me in the process. And I was so proud of him. I said, that is exactly the circumstances you should quit a job under.
You know, I wanted to just slightly shift the conversation a little bit because we've been talking about sons. I love my son. I worry about boys. I worry about men because I think, men, I think that you're oppressed. Yeah. I don't think the system works for any of us. We should all be thinking about how our pieces fit together and how it doesn't work very well. But I want to talk about my daughter a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a pretty blonde girl, and that's been the bane of her life. Mm-hmm. She's going to be 13 at the end of this month. And, you know, with Layla, we did the whole thing around letting her play what she wanted to play with. Didn't, you know, clog up the house with Barbies. Oh, does she want to play with dinosaurs? And because she had an older brother and they're very close, she's always tagged along the boys. Sometimes that's okay. Sometimes it's not. I think they handle it pretty well. But, you know, empowering her, talking her up, letting her know she's really smart. We've done all that. But you know what? She's afraid that she could be murdered by a stranger in the street. Mm. You know, it's funny because we figured that out last year. You know, Layla, why don't you want to ride your bike home by yourself? You know the way. You could do it. And it shocked me when I realized that that's something that looms in her mind.
Right.
And we don't talk about, we don't watch the news on TV. We don't read stories like that out loud in the newspaper. I don't even want to voice stuff like that. We know the level of violence by men against women. But I don't know what to do with that. I really don't. So I wanted to put it out to you.
Yeah, actually, that's so, whether you watch TV or not, she is around peers and people at school, and grown-ups feel really safe talking to kids about stranger danger. I mean, kids get that message everywhere. They're inundated with it. And I think it's just phenomenal that children are dealing every day with violence of all kinds, and yet they still are so afraid of this stranger and what the stranger might do to them. When the reality is, when kids are hurt, they're hurt by people they know. It's a very small percentage of the time that kids are hurt by people that they don't know. So I think you can provide kids with you know, the simple information that most people you don't know aren't going to try to hurt you. And just sort of making sure that you counteract the regular messages that they're getting that about stranger danger. And, I mean, I think it's appropriate to teach children some basic safety tools about people you don't know. So, right. You know, we don't know them, so we don't go hang out with them or go places with them.
Right.
But to stay away from that as much as possible. And then to really teach kids some basic tools for dealing with problems with people that they know, you know, that they do have the right to say no. I love your story about empathy and mm-hmm. having your child draw their feelings. I think it's our job as grown-ups is to help kids interpret the world and help them learn what they're feeling, help them understand what appropriate responses to those feelings are. And if we don't do that, then we leave them alone with their limited experience to try to interpret what's going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One of the things in our Kids Can program that we do, kind of backing up to you're talking about bystanders, but also the empathy building, is we practice with kids. We do some role plays about a kid who's acting like a bully, and we get kids in the class to come up and help us use their words and stand up to someone who's acting like a bully in a way that is respectful still. You know, that it's appropriate to feel angry or scared or nervous in this situation, and it's still not appropriate to act out and hurt another person. So what are nonviolent ways that you can resolve this problem? So I think it is really important at an early age to be teaching empathy and to be teaching children that it's important for you to stand up for yourself, but it's also important for you to stand up for those around you.
I'm really interested in the how-to. Like we say, we need to teach kids this, we need to teach that.
Yes.
But concrete examples of...
Yes.
That's really important, I think, the kind of information that people need. It's like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. It makes sense. Yeah, we should do that.
So you can literally practice. Like, we actually today, we were in a third grade class, and after doing the program, some kids came out afterwards and had all these ideas about other role plays they could do. So that's something that then we can leave the school with. Like, here are get your kids to come up with, what are the problems you're dealing with every day? And let's act them out. What are some ways you could respond to this? And then you have this opportunity to talk to them, because it is important to find out what is it that you're most afraid of, or what is it that you're dealing with today? And maybe it is that I'm dealing with, I get made fun of during lunch, or I sit alone during lunch. So, you know, act it out and help them come up with words they can use, because it is really hard. Kids sometimes will be like, I'm either good or bad, and grown-ups also. So we step back from labeling it and come up with language. What's the actual words you could use? And then that's what we do. Practice actual appropriate words. I don't like that. That's not okay. Just really concrete. And the more we practice, then the easier it is for kids in situations when we're not there to be able to do that.
Suzanne, I know you're fond of saying that, you know, in the classroom we practice writing an A 100 times before we're expected
right.
to be able to produce an A, but we don't practice these sorts
That's
of things.
Right.
And so I know Suzanne is involved in role-playing among preschoolers, and it's been successful so far.
Yeah.
If I may make a brief statement, Suzanne, apparently your audio line is a little bit weak for our listeners, so just want everyone out there to know that we're aware of the problem, and we've done everything in the studio to compensate for that and maintain your participation in this conversation. So if you can speak up a little bit, Suzanne, anything you would like to add about role-playing in your curricula, that would be very interesting.
Sure, I will try to toe the line between shouting and not heard.
Thanks.
I think that, as Leanne was saying, we have some very realistic expectations about skill building for young children. We know that it's going to take them a very long time to learn how to tie their shoes, and they're going to have to practice it over and over again. But as far as social and emotional skills do, we don't talk about practicing social and emotional skills, and conflict is one of those the primary examples of this. We spend a lot of time when working with children trying to help them avoid conflict. So, can we get out another toy so they don't have to fight about the one toy that's out? Can we steer them away and distract them from having this fight by, you know, doing something dramatic and funny? And from my perspective, children need to have conflict, because if they don't practice conflict, and if they don't have conflict all the time, they are going to be afraid of it. They're going to be afraid of what happens if somebody tries to bully me? What happens if someone takes my toy away? What happens, you know, and this goes on into the older years, you know, if teenage girls haven't ever had any sort of conflict, what's going to happen when someone tries to treat them in a way that's not acceptable? Mm-hmm. So we work with our preschool children and make conflict comfortable and make it okay by letting them practice it. You know, I think that we would live in a different world if every time two children started to fight about a toy, a grown-up came and stood right next to them and was present for it, but only came into the conflict when they were needed, when the children got stuck. And then when the children got stuck, what if the grown-up was there to say, okay, let's make sure that both of your voices are heard, and let's try to come up with a mutually acceptable solution. Our children, when they go to kindergarten, we worked with a conflict chart, like a really basic sort of physical representation of how to solve fights or how to solve any conflict over anything. And when they go to kindergarten, they can all do that all by themselves. They have internalized it so that when they get to a conflict, when there's not a grown-up around, they can figure out what to do because they've done it so many times in a really safe situation. Mm-hmm. And so what if we let our children practice conflict? And what if they saw conflict handled constructively and healthily in the home and in the world? We actually encourage some parents when we have children who are having issues with conflict, who we notice are avoiding conflict, we actually encourage parents at home to have mock conflicts, to say, fight over who's going to get to cook dinner.
Wow.
But to do it in a constructive way, you know, not in a let's shout and be, you know, for about it, but modeling the behavior they want the children to develop. Oh, you want to cook dinner? Oh, I want to cook dinner too. Oh, no, but I really feel like you just cooked dinner yesterday and I haven't cooked dinner all week. What are we going to do? You know, and so the children see healthy, respectful conflict happening. They know it's not a big deal. They know that it happens all the time, and they know that it's the way to reach an accord between two people.
Okay. That's a great idea.
It makes me think about, like, growing up as a kid in a family where if there was conflict, and I'd be like, oh, are you mad? I'm not mad. You know, so it's this huge thing to teach little people that, yeah, you can be mad and not hurt somebody. You can disagree and do it respectfully. And not only can you, everyone does it. It's normal.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it sounds like the work that Suzanne is doing is very similar to the kinds of work that we're doing also. And yet we have more of a focus on child abuse and domestic violence, but connecting it to that they are not separate. They are absolutely connected. And if you have a child that has some skills about how conflict should look, they are much more likely, when somebody is misusing their power and treating them disrespectfully, to have this very clear sense inside that that's not okay. I know that's not okay, right, because I've experienced it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would know when to seek help. They would know when they were out of their league because they could handle the basic stuff on their own.
Exactly.
What I think is also very important about your work, Suzanne and Jennifer, mm-hmm, is specifically, I know, Suzanne, that you've identified that girls have a very difficult time, dealing with conflict of any kind. They have a difficult time stating their true feelings out loud, because often in society we have an expectation that is so set that unless everything that comes out of their mouth is just sunshine and light, we don't want to hear it. We discourage that. So girls grow up not being able to say no and not understanding that their voice, that sometimes conflict and quote-unquote fighting back is self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're taught from a very early age to subvert their own feelings,
mm-hmm,
and their own needs for the needs of others. And I think in some populations that there's, you know, the boys are catching up. I think that's a skill that's being taught to many boys now. But some recent research did show that when they had a group of toddlers who were playing in a circle, and their mothers were all watching them, and I'm sorry, the research was only done on mothers, it's unfortunate bias, but they watched what happened when one of the toddlers took a toy away from the other toddler, and mothers of boys were three times more likely to help the girls regain the toy, whereas the mothers of girls were more likely to come in and pacify them and say, oh, it's okay, that child really needed the toy, and give them something else. So they're given this message from an early age to worry about the feelings of others, to kind of not try to rock the boat, to be, you know, let others have what they need and not get in fights or in conflicts.
Mm-hmm. I got confused. The mothers of boys.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that again?
Yeah, sure. Okay, the mothers who had boys in the circle, when their boy had the toy taken away from them, mm-hmm. they were three times more likely to help the boy get his toy back.
Okay.
Whereas if it was a girl, the mothers would tend to pacify them and point out the feelings of the other child.
Come on now, it's, you know, sharing.
Right. You know what we do in my family over that? We would put the toy in timeout.
Oh, that's great.
We'd, like, chastise the toy and tell the toy it was causing problems. But, you know, it's like sometimes you watch the kid. I don't know how to explain. Sometimes it's like, as a parent, as a mom or a dad, and I'm kind of psyched to see a lot more dads parenting anymore.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was there for us, sort of. But now I see a lot more dads with babies.
Yeah.
Dads with babies, and they know how to open the stroller. That's nice. And it's kind of cool because I don't think that I'm not always sure that they're getting the support they need either. And it's like you had said, you know, with this study, it was only done with moms and it wasn't done with dads. Sometimes I look at dads and I'm just curious how they handle it when they've got. I had two babies in diapers, and it's like, what do you do when they're both crying? But sometimes it's like it's hard to. Again, we've been talking about empathy and when to deal with conflict, when not to. Sometimes I think as a parent, I know it's hard for me to watch the kids have a conflict and play it out, because sometimes I'm empathizing with them. I'm thinking, what's going to happen in 2 minutes? And it can be really hard to just have the patience to shut up sometimes,
mm-hmm.
butt out. Shutting up and butting out is hard. I just have to say that. And then sometimes it's not appropriate. So I don't know. Like today, I could not shut up and butt out while this girl had this boy in a headlock. Although saying that out loud now here on International Women's Day, it sounds odd, doesn't it? The girl had the boy in a headlock.
Well, you know, I think I don't want to. I think that girls bully a lot, and I think that even though,
are you saying physically or
emotionally? Okay. Physically, I think physically too, but I think emotionally they do a lot of bullying. And in the studies for adult workplace bullying, women bully more women than anybody else bullies anybody. Like, the statistics are higher that women bully women, and that it's status blind. It's not like race, color, blah, blah, blah. It's just women bullying women. The statistics are much higher that's what's going on in the workplace. I think it's interesting, and there's probably lots of reasons for that. I mean, I look at, there's so many things. Like, I think that we could talk about girls, and I'm curious about, I know that girls still suffer, that we've really not, they're worried about things, to still, like, reach this amazing age of 13 and then they think that they're fat and that they don't have anything to say, you know? Like, all the girls in my life that were such bright, amazing intelligences hit 13 and every single one of them would go, hey, what's up? I don't know. You know? Hey, what do you think about that? I don't know.
Well, as from earliest years, they're not encouraged to use their own voice to be very clear about their feelings.
Except that they really were until they hit 13. I mean, these were girls that could tell you exactly what they thought, what they wanted, and then 13. It's like, I don't know.
But Cherie, you know, I just want to jump in real briefly and say, I think that also speaks to the compartmentalization of what the kids are going through. Because you're like me, and we've been giving the kids, the girls and the boys, that positive message, and then they walk out the front door.
Mm-hmm.
Or they turn on the TV. Mm-hmm. Or they watch Grand Theft Auto. God, help us, you know? I'm sorry.
I just want to let people know who you're listening to. This is Lisa Loving and Jennifer Talbot with Listen to Kids. And Leanne Kranz.
With our guest on the phone, Suzanne Marie Fanger.
And I'm Cherie Blackfeather. And we're talking about social aggression and relational aggression and emotional education.
Mm-hmm.
How to teach that.
But what was Suzanne going to say? You were going to say something a second ago.
Well, there's I was just going to bring up, there's a developmental leap, and forgive me, I'm a little too far from my psychology class to remember the official terminology, but at about the age of 13, there is a major developmental leap amongst children, which is, you know, in literature, which is why this transition and loss of confidence and loss of self-esteem tends to happen at that age. Girls have been inundated with these cultural messages, you know, the boys are everywhere, you know, the girls are not represented equally in the media, you know, no matter what we do with parents and teachers to protect them, girls get this message that they're not quite as equal as boys are, but at the age of 13, they're finally able to see it. They take this developmental leap where they can really sort of see their place in the outside world, and they kind of finally see the disconnect.
You know what? I remember that.
Realize things are not what they thought they were,
right.
And my gosh, I'm supposed to be pretty, but not, you know, pretty but not too gorgeous. I'm supposed to be smart but not too smart. I'm supposed to be able to get the man. You know, I have to get the hero at the end of the story. They're supposed to, you know, be really nice and never get upset and never get angry. And they are supposed to be really thin. And they finally, all those messages gel at about that age. And they finally realize what is expected of them and that it's impossible for them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We should probably wrap up and let listeners, don't we have like 3 minutes left? Am I imagining that?
We have about 3 minutes left.
So what I think we should do is let people know how to contact Suzanne and Jennifer and find out more about your work, because that's where it's going to be. It's encouraging people to go online or pick up a phone and find out more about what we can do.
Okay, excellent. So I'm Jennifer Talbot. You can contact me by calling Listen to Kids at 503-280-1388, or you can go to our website, which is just www.listentokids.org, and we have information about our programs. We do trainings in the community for children and adults, and we also, again, work with moms and kids who are leaving domestic violence situations.
And this is Suzanne Fanger speaking, and I can personally be reached at my email address, which is sfanger@yahoo.com. That's spelled S as in Sam, F as in Frank, ANGER@yahoo.com. If listeners are interested in learning more about relational aggression, I'm just going to direct them to the Ophelia Project, which is a nonprofit that works with relational aggression and has developed a lot of programs around relational aggression, and also to a book that I think is an excellent introduction to the subject. It's called Girl Fighting. Mm-hmm. And it's by Lynn Michael Brown, and it is a really well put together book about social aggression amongst girls, but it talks a lot about aggression across the lifespan in girls as well as why it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommended.
Thank you so much for joining us by phone. And
sure.
Yeah, this is great.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I heard your interview with Leanne on Bread and Roses, and I was like, this is a subject I want to continue to talk about.
We want to have you back, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And Jennifer.
It's really interesting. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for coming down today to KVU to talk with us today.
Sure.
And we'd like to have you back as well.
Yes.
I'd love to come back.
Thanks. And Lisa and Leanne, thank you so much.
You're Take welcome. Care of the kids and don't let them fight.
And I want to thank Judy, our engineer. Yay!
Okay, that was a fascinating roundtable discussion on raising kids. And today is special programming for International Women's Day. Coming up next, the Loringer Sisters from KBOO's Youth Collective talk about teen sexuality. But first, we hear a poem called Benediction for Gulls Making Love, by Verlene Orr.
Benediction for gulls making love. Gallantly, he stands on her back, wings slightly open, carefully finding his footing, sparing her inamorata, the full weight burden of his feathers, hollow bones. In common, driven by Darwin, I share their light of this morning's one candle, the rising sun. In small surrenders, she lowers her neck and head, accepts him, inamorato. No struggle or shrill protest, only her willingness. I feel a catch of breath in the universe. The collection for this day's offering, each day arrives, tabula rasa. We love this first time, and each time will be the first and the last. I like to believe you will wait with me, our turn to lean into rain, ignore small craft advisories, high wind ignites. Unashamed, the gulls part and preen. Out of reach as erotic dancers, they deftly smooth each feather into its proper place, their piece between sky and water. I found them just in time, moving into my heart's fourth dream, the one where I can fly.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Amber, and